You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
All right, so Paul is angry. We've talked about that for the last few weeks. We've talked about the fact that for three chapters now, he's been hammering home this idea of trying to counter the teachings of these false teachers who've come into this church in Galatia, this church that Paul deeply cares about. In fact, the very next section in this chapter, we see a bit of Paul's heart for this church, that he loves this church, that he cares deeply about this church, that he thinks of them almost as his children, longing for them to come into maturity and not give into the false teaching that's arisen as these teachers have kind of come into the church in Galatia to try to convince them that Paul only had it about half right. And we saw at the end of chapter 2 and then moving through chapter 3 last week, and we saw that Paul's central concern, that the main thing that he's countering is this idea that these false teachers have come in and said, look, you need to listen to Paul as far as he went. He said, you need to believe in Jesus in order to be accepted before God, in order to be clean before God, in order to be welcomed into the presence of God. You're right. You do need to believe in Jesus. But in addition to believing in Jesus, in order for the God of the universe to accept you, in order for the God of the universe to declare you righteous or in the right, you also need to do a few things. And supremely, the thing that they pointed to is kind of symbolic of everything else they were asking this church to do is you need to be circumcised. Because Paul refers to them as the circumcision party, which I've made the joke every week that that's not a party you want to be a part of. And so he says that they're saying, look, in order for God to love you, in order for God to fully accept you, in order for you to fully be welcomed in and really be a part of this family that goes all the way back to Abraham, you need to begin to obey the law. You need to do the things that God's commanded you to do. And if you do them well enough, then and only then will God accept you fully into his family. And so you can take that idea of circumcision and kind of plug into it whatever thing you want to plug into it. Because our world is inundated with that same foundational idea. And I don't care if you're religious or irreligious. If you've come from religious backgrounds, plug whatever morality you want to plug into it. So long as you've been baptized, then you'll be fully welcomed into God's family. So long as you pray enough, whatever enough means to you, if you pray once a day, or you pray before meals, or you pray twice a day, or you pray three times a day, whatever the thing is, as long as I believe in Jesus and I do X, then and only then will I be acceptable before the God of the universe. So this is the thing that Paul is confronting, and he's confronting it in the most harsh and angry terms possible. For Paul, this isn't a small thing. This isn't like an inconsequential disagreement between himself and these teachers. This is something that Paul says everything hangs on. Your whole understanding of who Jesus is, your acceptance before God hinges on whether or not you get this question right. Now, this morning we come to a section where Paul uses a phrase. It's a phrase that has been hotly debated through the ages. Nobody's quite sure how to translate it or how to convey the idea. And so we need to do a little bit of work up front to think about this phrase and to talk about this phrase together. And so the work we're going to do is kind of trying to understand the phrase elementary principles. So explicitly to the, he says in verse 3, when we were children, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. And then jump down to verse 9. He says, but now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world? Now, you know this is a word that's hard to translate because they just use the word principles. And so if you actually dive into what does it actually mean to say the word principles, it's kind of like they're saying, well, it's like the basic things, which means that people are struggling to know what the word means, right? If I ever tell you, yeah, I'm translating Spanish to you, and they said this word, and the word means like things. It's like the things of the world. That means I have no idea what I've just translated to you. I mean, I'm sure there's a word in Spanish that means things, but whatever. I don't know Spanish. So we need to do some work on this world thing, on this word, elementary principles of the world. And the whole idea of elementary principles of the world and the way it's used kind of within the Greek language, both in the Bible by Paul and also in the literature that was being written at the time and the language that's being spoken at the time, it points back to something that is foundational to the understanding of how the world actually works. But one of the things that's interesting when you come to the Bible is it doesn't just present us with kind of like a religious system that you plug into kind of the top of whatever worldview you have or whatever way that you have approaching the world. The Bible actually presents us, and it's intrinsic to kind of the argument that Paul's making in chapter 4. It actually presents us with a kind of a comprehensive understanding of how the world actually works. And this idea of the elementary principles, it assumes a problem that's foundational to the world, a problem that wasn't just kind of a problem that Paul identified or Christians identified in the first century. It was actually a problem that everybody knew about. And I would argue it's a problem that we actually know about, we just don't talk very much about. And so for us to understand elementary principles, we need to get at what is the problem that the elementary principles are trying to solve. And here's the problem it's trying to solve. The problem it's trying to solve is that we are all going to die. You see, everybody, I don't know if you know this, almost everybody. Evidently, my son, a 13-year-old boy, does not know this yet. But everybody knows that you're going to die. That death just kind of hangs over us. It haunts our culture. It haunts our world. And it stands over us as kind of the pervasive problem haunting our day. And here's why it's a problem. Death fundamentally represents to us, it kind of shouts to us, no matter what kind of accomplishments you have, no matter how moral you may think you are, no matter how strong you may be, no matter how many times a week you go to CrossFit, no matter how big your muscles, whatever the thing is, it is a constant reminder that we're weak. That something is fundamentally broken about who we are. Death doesn't just haunt us as a day that, hey, someday this is all going to come to an end. It actually is this constant reminder that things are not as they should be. Something is not right. That our bodies, these fleshy bodies, what Paul refers to our life in our body as life in the flesh, that these bodies, these fleshy bodies are weak, that they're broken, and in referring to the language of the first century, that they're actually unclean. But here's the problem. The problem isn't just our bodies. There's nothing in our bodies in and of themselves that are bad. It's just that we were always meant to live with God. And yet something has happened, something that the Bible calls sin, that keeps us from the presence of God, that keeps us marked by a kind of unrighteousness, marked by a kind of uncleanness, marked by a sense that we're not welcomed into the presence of God. And so we're kind of trapped in this state of uncleanness, trapped in this state of not being accepted, trapped in this state of not being welcomed into the presence of God. And that problem haunts our world. That sense of our own weakness, our own bodily weakness, corrupts and touches everything. I was reading a book by a guy named Peter Lighthart this week, and he describes our fleshy weakness, our bodily weakness, and how that actually spreads out in kind of this universal way, again, whether you're religious or irreligious, to touch everything in our world. And I thought this was a helpful quote, so I'm going to read it. But weakness is the source of boastful displays of strength and virility. Those who live in the fear of death, in fleshy weakness, are thus prone not only to feelings of insecurity, low self-esteem, obsessions, perfectionism, but also to ambitiousness, envy, narcissism, jealousy, rivalry, competitiveness, self-consciousness, guilt, and shame. Insofar as it is mortal and vulnerable, flesh desires pleasure and avoids pain. It can express itself in desire for luxuries and wealth, in greed and all the cruelty that greed produces. It can express itself in a desire for power and dominance. It is the source of libido dominant, the driving sexual desire. You see, life according to the flesh can take the form of confidence in one's achievements. Jews boast in their zeal for the law. Greeks boast in their potency in battle, in public debate, in sexual conquest. The problem with our weakness, the problem that the elementary principles of the world are designed to address, is the fact that that kind of awareness, that awareness that death hangs over us and therefore we're weak, leads to lives. It leads not just to lives, it leads to social systems, it leads to political systems, it leads to whole views of race and all manner of things. It leads to a kind of life that's constantly trying to compensate or overcome the reality that we are fundamentally broken. And it haunts everything. And that problem has been, we've been trying to solve that problem for thousands of years. And this phrase, elementary principles of the world, is used all over the place in the first century to refer to this kind of fundamental way that we've ordered the world, both personally and socially and politically, in order to try to deal with that weakness, in order to try to deal with that sense, that keen kind of haunting sense that something's wrong with us and that we're unclean. And so, what would that have looked like in the first century if you're in Galatia? So most of the people that Paul's addressing are coming out of kind of a Roman or Gentile, non-Jewish culture. They've kind of been living life as Romans in Galatia. They were somehow confronted with the gospel from Paul, and then they came to believe that the gospel is true. But prior to that, and surrounding them in the culture, was a whole approach to ultimately dealing with this problem. It wasn't a Christian way of dealing with this problem. It wasn't a Jewish way of dealing with this problem, but it was a distinctly Roman way of dealing with this problem. And the distinctly Roman way of dealing with this problem, it was all of the temples that pervaded, kind of the pantheon of gods that pervaded Roman society at the time. And so within your life as a Galatian citizen, just trying to say, you were just trying to run a, let's call it a falafel shop. I feel like I want a falafel today. So in running your falafel shop, you wanted to run your falafel shop well, and yet haunting your life, haunting society, is the sense we're all going to die, in the sense that we're not accepted, the sense that somehow we have to compensate for our own weakness, our own brokenness. And so you would go to the god of falafels. And if you were serving wine, you would go to, where's my daughter telling me the name of the god that's god of wine? What? Dionysus? Dionysus. You would go to the temple of the god of Dionysus. You would drink some wine. You'd cover your body in wine. You'd make some sort of weird sacrifice to the god. And then that would somehow make you clean, which would then allow you and free you to have a successful falafel shop. And wine. Good wine with your falafels. That makes falafels better. And so you would live in this constant tension, this constant rhythm of kind of obeying certain days, obeying certain festivals, making sure you made the right sacrifice at the right time, making sure you worked hard enough, but you kept your falafel shop clean and free from all the things that would corrupt it morally or corrupt it religiously or kind of offend the god Dionysus. Whatever the thing was, you would kind of keep your life ordered in such a way and disciplined in such a way and marked by going to the temple, making the right sacrifices, drinking the right wine on the right day, and making the right prayers at certain times. And before you made your falafel, you would do some sort of ceremony. You would do all the things in the right order, in the right way, in order to keep in check this constant awareness that we're weak, this constant awareness that we're unclean, this constant haunting sense that we're unrighteous, that we're going to die someday. And so you do your religious duty. You keep up the ceremonies. You keep up the sacrifices. You say your prayers at the right moment. You keep the moral code. You honor the emperor. You order your life in such a way through these disciplines, through these religious ceremonies, through whatever the thing is, in order to make sure that you can actually somehow, in the day-to-day grind of running your delicious falafel and wine shop, and that you can somehow overcome death, overcome weakness, overcome brokenness, and have some sense in the day-to-day that you're accepted, you're enough, and you can succeed. Now this plays itself out not only in kind of religious systems in the first century, but it plays itself out in religious systems in our own day. It plays itself out in political systems of our own day. And one of the things that kind of marks the elementary principles of the world is that it always divides the world into clean and unclean. And it's interesting, as you walk through history, we've come up with system after system after system of trying to figure out who are the clean ones and who are the unclean ones. Who are the ones who are acceptable and who are the ones who are not acceptable? I happen to teach a ninth grade history at this wonderful school called Augustine Classical Academy. And at the school, we've been walking through, they just read, and I just want to say this, ninth graders. We just read the Communist Manifesto, and we're in the middle of the wonderful piece of literature, Mein Kampf. And so, I'm joking. It's a horrific, awful, terrible, boring. But anyway, here's two political systems, right? So here's Marxism on the one hand, and here's National Socialism on the other side, and they both are responsible for the death of millions and millions and millions and millions of people. And at the heart of both of them is the question, how do we define the clean and the unclean, and how do we prove ourselves to be among the clean ones? And free market capitalism is the exact same thing, right? Only now it's defined not in terms of the oppressed and the oppressor on both sides of those things. Now it's defined in terms of, can you achieve enough? Can you accumulate enough wealth? Can you be the one that works hard enough to prove that you're a hard worker, that your life has value, that can somehow, through the accumulation of wealth, through the achievement of your life, kind of somehow supersede death and somehow prove yourself to be clean? We build entire political structures and social structures addressing this basic idea, this fundamental problem that death haunts us. And we need a system. We need some sort of religion, even if it's an atheistic religion, but we need or a secular religion. We need some sort of religious system to help us grapple with the fact that we're all going to die, that we're weak. We somehow need to compensate with this brokenness. But let's bring it out of the realm of systems and programs and politics. We all wake up every single morning haunted by this same problem. And I don't know what the particular thing is that you've picked, but whether it's being liked, I have to be liked, I have to be accepted. People have to think I'm a nice person. Or maybe it's achievement. Or maybe it's the accumulation of wealth. Or maybe it's somehow your own moral fortitude. I don't know what the thing is that you've chosen as your means of battling your own sense of your own insecurity, born of your own bodily weakness. But all of us are drawn to something. All of us are sucked into this drive every single day that somehow, apart from the grace of God, apart from the mercy of God, I'm going to make something of myself. I'm going to overcome death. I'm going to prove that I'm among the clean ones. And these, whatever those are, that whatever those are born of, Paul calls the elementary principles of the world. And this isn't just kind of a one-off idea for Paul. He says, this is the way the world works. This is what drives and motivates every culture, every religious system, every society, every approach to politics, every approach to sociology is this fundamental problem. It's a startling claim. But I would encourage you to test it, to think about it, to think it through. If you're a history buff, like, examine the path of, that history has taken. And I actually believe at the heart of it, you're going to find this question haunting everything. We create rules that we live under, principles, systems that are designed specifically to help us deal with this question. Now, here's what Paul does, which is this move that if you're a Jew in the room in the first century, you want to like burn the whole place down. Because here's what Paul does that's shocking. He says that the law of God is one of the elementary principles of the world. And none of you look shocked. You all look like, why is he making a big deal of that? Because if you're a Jew in the first century, this is how you should live in the world. This is the right way to be. This is how God accepts us. This is how we become clean and not unclean. Here's how we're different from all those dirty Gentiles that worship pagans. And Paul's argument here in Galatians 4 is that if you, as someone who's believed in Jesus, now try to go get circumcised in order to prove that you're acceptable before God, what you're doing is going back and beginning to serve again the elementary principles of the world. You're going back into a system that is designed to try to, through your own efforts, through your own fleshy efforts and weak body, to overcome that weakness and prove that you're good enough. He says, you're just like the pagans if you do that. You're just like the idol worshipers if you do that. You're just like the people going to the temple of Zeus or Dionysus or whatever temple they're going to. You're just like them if you accept circumcision. Because he says, here's what the law was designed to do. We talked about this last week. It was meant to be a set of rules, a set of boundaries that held the people of God in place in a world that was ruled by those elemental principles, a world that was haunted by the sense of death and our own weakness. God gave the law to the people of God to say, obey this, live under this, be circumcised, do all of these things. And there's a lot that can be said about how the law was designed to express and to expose that weakness and cause us to cry out in our need upon God. But he says those rules were put in place, but they were just put in place for a season, that we should come under the law of God in that way, but for a season until a day would come in which he would deal with the fundamental problem in a new way. And so I want to think together about how that functioned. And so when I was growing up, I thought about this story today. When I turned 16, I got to drive, and I had a car, and some friends and I were, I guess I was 17 at this point, we were going to drive to Dallas, and we were going to go to Six Flags Over Texas. And Six Flags Over Texas was awesome. It had large roller coasters, and we were going to go with this group of friends, and we were going to drive down there, and we were going to go, but we had to take two cars because we couldn't all fit in my car. And so my mom's car was a giant gray Suburban. Huge, awesome thing. And so we all wanted to ride together, and so I talked to my mom, hey, can I just drive the Suburban, and we can all pile in the car, we can all go down to Texas, or go down to Six Flags together, that way we can all ride in the same car. And my mom, beyond my comprehension as a 17-year-old, said, no, you don't get to drive my car. Secondly, and you don't get to drive my car with all of your 10 high school friends in it. Which just seemed ridiculous to me. It's a waste of gas, one, because now I take two cars, maybe even three cars. It was just an completely incomprehensible rule, this rule that just kind of stood over us and said, hey, you can't drive this car, you can't all ride in the same car together. What we ended up hiding my car in the parking lot of a grocery store and taking my mom's car. Anyway, And I don't remember all the details of how that was going to work, how we thought that was going to work, but it didn't work. Because we got home, she knew that I'd taken her car. And so, but we thought it was going to work at the time, which shows that this was a stupid idea to begin with. But as we got home and I got in trouble and got my car taken away for a few weeks, like, Mom was very kind and tried to explain to me, hey, this rule was in place because you're 17, and you in the car with 10 of your friends, your high school friends, is like, it's just not going to go well. Like, you're not going to pay attention to the road. Things, really bad things are going to happen if you're driving 2 hours to Dallas to go to Six Flags with all of your 10 friends in the same car. Essentially, we're saying, look, you're weak. You're bodily weak. 10 teenagers in the car. You're not going to pay attention to the road. You're not going to drive the way you would normally drive. There's just a handful of people in your car. You're going to be distracted. It's going to be crazy. I know some of your friends, and they're going to be crazy. And it's just, it's going to be more dangerous than I want it to be. And that's why I didn't want you to drive my car. Although, we didn't have a wreck, and it was awesome. So, in trouble. But the idea was, like, here's a rule that doesn't apply to me later. A rule that I don't have to live under later, but it's put in place during a season in which I'm acknowledging my own weakness. Now, could that rule make me a better driver? No. Could that rule deal with the weaknesses I had as a 17-year-old boy who's distracted by the fact that there's girls in the car and there's loud boys in the car and there's all the things happening in a 17-year-old Suburban? Not the Suburban 17, we're all 17. Like, there's no way. It couldn't deal with it, but it was meant, it was intended to keep us safe. It was intended to keep us, to deal with or to compensate for the weaknesses we had, or I had specifically, as a 17-year-old boy. This is what Paul is saying, circumcision, and this whole system of approaching God and finding our cleanness was meant to do. It was meant to kind of keep us safe, keep things in place, kind of keep the world ordered, To compensate for our weakness until God did something about it. And so what Paul says to the Galatians and he says to us is, look, if you go back there, if you go back to circumcision, if you try to add to the work of Jesus through circumcision, through baptism, through saying your prayers, through achieving something at work, through making sure you've got some sort of moral perfection to bring to God, through somehow showing that I've been good enough, I've done enough, I'm religious enough, I'm moral enough, whatever the thing is, if you try to add to the gospel with your good works or with your morality or with your own achievements, if you try to bring those things together, here's what you're doing. You're going back to this kind of essential paganism that says, I'm going to overcome my own weakness through my achievements. Through my religious achievements, through my economic achievements, through my moral achievements, whatever it is. You've gone back to an old system, and here's what Paul says about it. Look again at verse 9. He says that, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world? It says if you go back there, you're going to something that's weak. Here's the thing, that the problem with the law of God is not that it's not good. It's that it can't do what you're trying to make it do. It was never designed to. The thing about using baptism as a way to get to God or using prayer as a way to earn something with God, the problem with using morality as somehow a means to get to God, the problem with whatever the thing is, using it as a means to get to God, is that whatever that rule is, whatever that system is that you kind of either build for yourself or adopt from somewhere else, they are weak and powerless. They can't do what you're asking them to do. Paul says this in Romans about the law, what the law could not do. The problem is not with the law. The problem is that we're weak. And you're trying to use it to do something it was never designed to do. Prayer was never meant to prove something to God. Your sexual morality was never meant to prove something to God. Your ability to exercise self-control around food or exercise or alcohol was never meant to prove something to God. Your ability to keep a moral code was never meant to prove something to God. Your obedience to God's law was never put there so you could prove something to him. It can't make you clean. It can't overcome death. It can't overcome your brokenness. It can't resolve that haunting anxiety that I'm not good enough. Because it was never designed to do that. Again, whether you take something like the Mosaic Law in the Old Testament, or you take whatever religious code you're trying on now, or whatever secular achievement you're trying to hang your hat on, it simply can't do it. So what is Paul's solution? How does he answer it? Look at verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. He says two fundamental things. One, we're past all that now. You can't go back. You can't go back to that way of living. You see, something has happened. Something decisive has happened in the history of the world that has changed the entire nature of the way that the world works. And for those who believe in Jesus, those who trust in him, the world is not the same. You can't live with those elementary principles anymore. You can't live under those regimes anymore. You can't live under those systems anymore because we've simply passed that now. You see, the way he describes the coming of Jesus is not just kind of this private, kind of momentary, kind of religious experience. No, the way he describes the coming of Jesus, it is the central marker in the transformation of the world. The world works differently now. You can't rely on those systems, that the world is ordered in such a different way now because Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, in the weakness of flesh, and yet he never compromised, he never sinned, he never rebelled against God. He dies in our place, and he was raised on the third day, and that kind of movement, that three-day transformation has changed the entire nature of the world. So you can't live in that place anymore. The second thing he says that was accomplished in the coming of Jesus, the world was transformed, and it was transformed in this way that all who believe in Jesus have become sons and daughters of God. We've become heirs. You don't have to go to the Temple of Dionysus anymore. You don't have to achieve anymore. You don't have to get baptized. You don't have to pray the right prayer. You don't have to do all the right things in order to find yourself accepted and loved and sung over by the God of the universe. He has overcome our weakness, our brokenness, our uncleanness, our sin, our death. Not by giving us a system. If we do the right things in the right order, we will somehow overcome this thing called death. He's done it by rescuing us and adopting us. This is the central announcement of the gospel. That those elementary principles, those systems of self-salvation that we are constantly tempted by and are hung over us by our culture, by the world that surrounds us, and by our own fleshy, weak desires to somehow prove that we're enough, are weak. They cannot save you. They cannot rescue you. And so what we could not do, what those systems cannot do, God has done. He's done by the sending of Jesus. He has done by sending Jesus to rescue us from sin and death and the weakness of our own flesh. And he's done it by adopting us accepting us, giving us a new name and a new identity in Jesus. Not one that we've earned, not the one that we've built for ourselves, but one that has been freely given to us in the body and blood of Jesus. Let's pray.